Live from the Business Radio X studio inside Renaissance Bank, the bank that specializes in understanding you. It's time for North Fulton Business Radio.
And hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of North Fulton Business Radio. I'm John Ray, and we're virtual, folks. Still not back in our usual quarters inside Renaissance Bank on Windward Parkway in Alpharetta, but we're looking forward to being back there someday soon. In the meantime, if you're looking for a better, more personal experience for your business, for your family, Renaissance is a great way to go. I know that personally because of the clients that I work with, and they've been terrific on helping formerly non-bank customers with PPP loans, and a lot of those non-bank customers have become customers, and they've enjoyed that experience. So you might want to try the same. Go to renaissancebank.com, find your local office. They've got 200 around the South ready to serve you, and give them a call, make an appointment, and go see them. Renaissance Bank, understanding you, member FDIC. And now I want to welcome Jonathan Wilson. And Jonathan is a partner with Taylor English Duma. Jonathan, welcome.
Morning, John.
Great to have you here.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah.
Great to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you. So tell us a little bit about you and your firm. How are you serving folks?
Sure. Well, I've been at Taylor English Duma now for about 11 years. I've been a lawyer since 1991. I grew up in Pennsylvania and went to college at William & Mary in Virginia, and law school at George Washington University, and came to Atlanta in 1991 with the Powell Goldstein firm. And during the interview process, back then they would call you down to Atlanta, you'd get on a plane, and you'd have a whole day of interviews. And the night before your first interview, you would go out to dinner with a partner and an associate. And they tried to include an associate who had gone to the same undergraduate institution as you had. And back in 1990, the only undergraduate from William & Mary of the Powell Goldstein firm was Mark Taylor. So after I went through my career, which we can always talk about later, in 2009, when I was looking for a new home for my practice, I had the opportunity to get back together again with Mark Taylor, literally the first lawyer I ever met.
Wow.
But we're now about 180 lawyers, roughly 160 or so of which are here in Atlanta. About two dozen are all over the country, and they're what we call our remote partners. They're full partners of the firm, but they work from home. 6 months ago, that was unusual. Now, not so much. And what it allows us to do is it allows us to have the geographic reach of being a national law firm, but we only have to bear the cost of a single office here in Atlanta. That allows us to be a lot more efficient in the way we deliver services. And it means that our overall cost of delivering on a project is usually less than what it would be if you went to a traditional, you know, what we call an Am Law 200 firm, one of the 200 biggest firms in America. So we like to think that we have a national practice at a very competitive rate, and it allows our partners to have the quality of life that they enjoy doing high-level legal work, but in a way that, you know, gives you a lot more flexibility with your home and family, and also allows you to be more directly engaged in the transaction, in the project with the client.
Wow, that's a whole nother show right there on how, because I would imagine, you're quite an attractive place for someone, an experienced attorney, to hang their hat these days, given that work-life home flexibility.
It's interesting. We certainly didn't anticipate the pandemic, and you know, don't want to understate you know, its severity and how awful it's been for everyone.
Sure,
but we had built the remote platform as a way to deliver value in a better and more efficient way to clients. At our firm, no one gets a salary. Everybody takes home a percentage of what they bill and collect. Mm. And if I give a piece of client work to my colleague down the hall, in essence, I am paying them out of my bank and billing the client for that work. And I don't get paid until I collect it from the client and then net out what I've had to pay my colleague down the hall. The reason why that matters to the client is it gives me a financial incentive to be efficient. In contrast, in the traditional law firm shaped like a pyramid, there's not a whole lot of economic incentives for efficiency, other than perhaps your long-term reputation. So we built our firm with a view towards being efficient. And when we decided that we wanted to grow cross-country, one of the first things we said was, we can't afford to go open up an office in New York and Washington and Dallas. How are we going to do that? Well, we decided to grow virtually with partners working from their homes. Now, post-pandemic, when everyone is already working from home, a lot of the Am Law 200 firms are either halting payments to their partners or downsizing partners by category. And so if you're a successful attorney at another firm, you can very often charge your clients less and make more money working off of the Taylor English platform. And I was one of the co-authors of the business plan 5 years ago when we put this together. It actually is tending to draw an awful lot of interest from partners and other law firms who are looking for a better way to manage their practices now that they're working from home.
Wow. I would imagine you're probably in a position of saying, take a number, take a seat. We'll get to you as fast as we can, but we'll have to do revisit that one. That's a awfully interesting business model, but I want to get to you and your practice and how you work with businesses and business owners. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the kind of business law that you practice.
Sure. So, John, most of my practice these days falls into one of two categories. Large strategic transactions with enterprises that involves intellectual property and usually some sort of joint venture. The other category are small and medium-sized businesses, sometimes startups, but often family-owned businesses that are just in that, you know, $10 to $50 million range. And they have all the types of problems that any other business has. They need to make sure that they own their intellectual property. They need to onboard their employees in a legal way that's going to give them a clean paper trail when they go to sell the business. They need to capitalize their business. So if they're looking to raise funds from investors or borrow money from a bank, you need to paper that up in the right way. And all those steps of the process are all built towards building a business that's in a position to get sold one day. Whether it's getting sold to a strategic buyer, sold to a financial buyer, or even sold back to the employees of the business themselves in the form of an ESOP transaction. In any event, whether you're exiting one way or the other, it's sort of like building a house. You need to start with a firm foundation, and then you do the framing, and then you build the walls. And if you don't pay attention at each step of the process, by the time you're done, there's going to be a crack somewhere. And that crack could cost you a little bit of money, or it could cost you a lot of money, but it's definitely going to cost you money. So my role is to avoid the cracks and to build the building that is your business carefully from the basement all the way to the roof.
You get involved, Jonathan, with a lot of different financing options, I guess, that business owners have and family businesses have. Why don't you address some of the more popular options today, and I guess which ones are better suited for different kinds of businesses?
That's a great question, and I literally teach a class on that as a CLE class for lawyers called the mini MBA for attorneys about how to structure financing. The first thing to think about is, do you need debt or do you need equity? If you are building some sort of a capital asset that is going to produce fairly forecastable revenues, debt is usually the best way to go. Think about a widget factory. If you're already in the widget business, you know that you can manufacture the widgets, that you can sell them, that customers want them, and you want to build a bigger factory to make more widgets. That's a debt transaction. You go to a bank, you borrow money, you build your bigger factory. Now you have more revenues, more profits, and those profits go to pay down the debt. Once you've amortized the debt, you've now added equity to your balance sheet and you're making more profits than you made before. That's a debt transaction. Most startups, they don't yet know if they can manufacture the widget. They haven't made one. They only have a prototype. They're not sure if customers are going to buy the widgets. Part of the reason for the startup is that this widget is different from all previous widgets. Maybe we're disrupting the widget industry, something like that. But the capital is very much at risk. Well, banks don't make loans when capital is at risk. Banks only make loans on sure things. If you need capital to build something that's, you know, never before been attempted widget, that really is an equity transaction. You need to go to potential equity investors. And that's probably where I get a lot more involved, because equity can mean different things for different people. Whether you're a corporation or an LLC or a partnership, helping the business owner understand the different alternatives for raising equity is something I spend a lot of time on in my day-to-day practice.
You mentioned family businesses, and you work with a lot of family businesses. I think you mentioned 10 to 50 million, somewhere in that area. How do you look at transition? Because that's something we hear a lot about that transitions, a lot of transitions are coming just because of demographics. And maybe there are a lot of family business owners whose sons and daughters don't want to be in the business. How do you see that, Jonathan? What does that landscape look like for you?
Well, it looks like a lot of different things, despite families look very differently. But you very often find that the family business was founded by grandpa or great-grandpa. And now there are, you know, two generations or more family members involved. You might have some who are involved in management, others who are involved in other positions. They want to preserve what they view as the family legacy. And at the same time, the older generations have a need to monetize their capital and take some cash off the table. There are a variety of different ways to solve those sorts of problems. And it almost always involves with some kind of family meeting for people to kind of lay their cards on the table and have a clear understanding of what everyone's needs are. The older generation needs to take cash off the table. The younger generation needs to preserve the business to keep their jobs. There are others who have a long-term capital appreciation goal. And step one is really to understand the perspectives of everyone involved. Depending on how those perspectives line up or don't, you might look at selling the business. You might look at some sort of leveraged buyout in which the business would borrow cash. The cash would be used to redeem the interests of the older generations. Mm-hmm. And then the younger generations would take the business and run it in hopes of repaying that bank loan. Another alternative I mentioned is the ESOP. That's a whole nother show. Those are very complicated transactions.
Right.
But for those listeners who may have heard of ESOPs, you actually form a separate trust, which in essence buys all the stock of the company. The trust then borrows money, usually from a bank, that is used to pay off the founders who are selling their stock. And then the trust owns the business and runs it for the benefit of the employees. And employees over time can accrue an equity ownership in the business through the trust. If you do it the right way, you can even structure it so that a lot of the cash that comes out to the founding owners comes out on a tax-reduced or even a tax-free basis. And sometimes it can also be structured in a way where if there is subsequent appreciation in the value of the business, the owners have warrants or options to acquire additional equity from the trust that can even give them a second bite of the apple if the business takes off in the future in a way that it hasn't by the time you do the ESOP. But that's a whole other way of looking at the strategic exit as a process more than a transaction in time.
Well, and that creates a transition option that maybe a lot of folks don't know about. I mean, they think about their sons and daughters and family, and they really maybe don't think about necessarily the employees per se, but that might be a great option for folks.
It very often is. Like I said, these are complicated transactions. There's a lot of tax issues involved. I have a partner who gets very involved in these and probably does more than anyone else in the Southeast. But a business with anywhere from 10 million or more in revenues, 2 million or more in EBITDA, usually more than two or three dozen employees, That is in the sweet spot for a small company, ESOP, and we're happy to talk to family-owned businesses that that have those sorts of needs.
Folks, we're here chatting with Jonathan Wilson, and Jonathan is a partner with Taylor English Duma. Jonathan, you mentioned strong foundations. That kind of brings up startups and creating a strong foundation as you start the business and grow the business. Talk a little bit about what you think makes a startup successful and the pitfalls they need to avoid.
Sure. Well, my first experience with a startup was when I was in college, which was a long, long time ago. That was about 1987. Listeners who are old enough to remember, that was the first time that we were actually buying PCs. The word PC was a new word. Before that time, you know, business people didn't have computers on their desks. The idea that a business person would have a computer on their desk was really a new thing. Frankly, a lot of men said, oh, a keyboard. I'm not a secretary. What would I do with a keyboard?
Oh, dear. Yeah.
But that was the world as it was in 1986, 1987. I was at the College of William & Mary, and my roommate and I had computers. We were just starting to use them for class. We found that we could produce term papers more efficiently by typing them up and editing them on the screen than typing them on a typewriter and having to, you know, white out your typewriter, which was the way that was done back then. But we had an opportunity for a family friend to develop a software program to help him keep track of orders. He was an independent sales rep in the furniture industry, and he would drive around Virginia every day going to furniture stores. And they would say, Bubba, we need another American 200 in Sheridan. He would write that on a piece of paper. He would walk down the street to the payphone, because no cell phones in 1987, and he would call a factory to place the order. And then he would put that piece of paper in a box in the trunk of his car. And 6 months later, the next time he went by that particular store, they would say, Bubba, how's my order for American 200 and Sherry coming along? He would go down the street and call the factory and find out. Well, obviously, that was very inefficient, even though it had been working for him for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so we built basically a compiled version of a spreadsheet that allowed him to enter orders and then kept track of them. It was actually done on a software program called Lotus 1-2-3, which is the thing we used before we had Excel.
Yep.
If you remember that.
All right.
And we built this software program for him. It worked well enough that he paid us to support his use of the software. And one of our business professors said, you know, this could make a neat little business. I'd like to invest in you. And let's see if we can't sell this to other furniture sales reps, just like your buddy. So we went and improved the software. We made a user manual, and we started to travel around the country while we're still in college, going to furniture conventions to try to sell this software to other independent sales reps. It turns out we were a little bit ahead of our time. None of the sales reps wanted to buy the software unless we could also sell them a computer, because none of them had computers. And every single one of them had to be trained on how to use the computer. And we just couldn't find a way to make that economical. So my roommate and I decided to go to law school, and we took that experience with us. But the moral of that story is there are lots of market opportunities out there. Not all of them make a great business. Mm. And from a very early age, I figured out that all the work that we had to do with that company, creating the software, creating a user manual, negotiating with our investor, business professor who gave us the money. We had assignments of intellectual property rights from us as founders. We got a little stipend, and we had an employment agreement. All of that paperwork had to get done just so that we could spend 18 months to figure out that nobody really wanted to buy our widget. It was a good widget, and it worked well for the one guy who wanted it, but we didn't have a market opportunity yet because the widget buying market, those independent sales reps, didn't have computers to run our software. Mm. So one of the things that I would tell a startup entrepreneur, just because you have a great product, you don't know that you're going to have a great start. You need to think through the business development process. Am I really going to be able to sell something that consumers want? And if consumers want it, are they really going to be in a position to buy it? Do they have the computers that they need to run the software that's so great? too often entrepreneurs think that they have a great idea, and that means that they're going to have a great startup. But great startups can't succeed unless they think through the business process from beginning to end. And often that involves spending a little bit of money on people who have done this a few times before.
Good words from Jonathan Wilson, and he is a partner with Taylor English Duma. So, Jonathan, how do you see the startup community in Atlanta? Since you've got experience in this area, I mean, how do you assess the startup community?
Sure. I think we have a pretty vibrant startup community in Atlanta. Definitely more vibrant here than elsewhere in the Southeast, I think. It's very different from what you see in Silicon Valley and on the West Coast. We'll talk about the differences there. But it's been, several decades now. We've had people from the pre.com era and the post.com era who have founded entities and had successes. So there's a pretty good network of angel investors, law firms, accounting firms who know how the startup process works, and they're fairly easy to find. You've got well-established organizations like the ATDC at Georgia Tech, Kennesaw State and University of Georgia both have incubators as well. There are tons of independent organizations, different gathering of angels and Atlanta Technology Angels, groups like that. So if you're an entrepreneur in Atlanta, you've got a pretty rich reservoir of referral sources and people who are willing to brainstorm with you as you get started.
So let's get to that magic point where you think you're ready to sell your company. Maybe you can address a couple of different aspects of this topic. One is just what that environment looks like right now, because it's obviously things have changed in the last few months since a pandemic came along. And also just in general, what you should expect from the process and how you as an attorney help in that process.
Sure. So from my point of view, the M&A market has not changed that much in the last 6 months, believe it or not. I'm in the middle of probably a half dozen transactions that are on the early side of things, which means that we either have term sheets or expect to have term sheets soon. And here we are, August the 24th of 2020. If you're looking at a term sheet in August, you're probably hoping to close by Thanksgiving. And that's still a reasonable likelihood. If things go longer, now you're looking to close before the end of the year. So we're setting up our fourth quarter deal cycle right now. There are often entrepreneurs that go out and first try to find a buyer and then go and talk to their lawyer. I would actually encourage people to do it the other way around. First, talk to your lawyer and then go out and try to look for a buyer. And it goes back to that analogy of building the house from the foundation up. It's one thing to get a buyer and get a term sheet with a price in it, but inevitably you're going to have to go through due diligence. And due diligence is going to be one of the most intrusive experiences you've ever gone through as a business person. From a business person's point of view, it can be mind-numbingly boring. And yet it's the process of looking for cracks in your house. And you would feel much more confident as a business seller knowing that your house had no cracks. And how do we do that? Well, if you're working with me and many other lawyers in this space, you first start off by building what we call a virtual data room. And I'd say, John, tell me about your business. You tell me about the business. I say, okay, I have a spreadsheet here with about 165 lines on it. And I'm going to ask you to identify for me every document that is responsive to any one of those 165 information requests. Now, probably 100 of those 165 will be not applicable. That's okay. It's good that I've asked you the question and you said there are none, because that tells me I don't need to look again. And when the buyer asks us about it, we can say there's nothing here. But probably 65 out of the 165 will lead to some sort of document or some sort of story that we need to tell. For example, we're going to look for a list of all of your employees. I'm going to ask you, do you have a written employment agreement with every one of those employees? I'm going to ask you, are you paying those employees correctly? Are they getting time and a half when they work more than 40 hours if they are not exempt from the law that requires that? And how do we know which employees are exempt from our Fair Labor Standards Act and which ones are not? We're going to go through that process. 99% of the time, small businesses don't get that particular issue right, and they're not paying overtime when they need to. Well, we sort of like when you go to the dentist and you haven't been taking care of your teeth, we may have to drill a few cavities, but you're going to look a lot prettier when we're done drilling the cavities. And you definitely don't want to drill the cavities when you're in the middle of having the discussion around your term sheet. So we would probably go through a 30, 45, maybe even 60-day process to look for all the cracks and then go fix them all. And then we begin the process of trying to find a strategic buyer for your business.
What you're talking about there is, I mean, you use the dental analogy, which I find a kind of a painful analogy, what you're really talking about is that deferred maintenance maybe is another analogy that needs to be caught up, because folks can either pay you and your colleagues to help with that, or they can get the results of that taken off the value of the business when they come to sell, right?
That's exactly right. There is no avoiding the cost of legal complaints. You either pay at one end or pay at the other. And by and large, it's cheaper to pay your lawyer to get these things done right beforehand than it is to discount your purchase price if you're able to find a buyer after the fact.
So speaking of lawyers, let's talk about how to find a good one. We've talked a little bit about how a good one can help, but you may have some more thoughts on that beyond just how a good attorney can help in selling the business, but how to look for the best ones.
Sure. Well, finding a good lawyer is more a function of the problem you need to solve than it is a question of who you know. It's great if you have a lawyer in your circle of friends. He might be the buddy from the golf course or someone you know from church. And by all means, talk to those close friends about who they know and who they recommend. But if you're looking for a lawyer for your business, you probably want to interview three or four lawyers who have experience with businesses of your kind, businesses of your type, and get a sense of how they interact with you. Because the lawyer that you know from church who does divorces might be a great friend, might be a good family lawyer, but he probably hasn't done a lot of business work before. And you really want to buy, like a tool for a job, you want to buy the right lawyer for the right project. Some of the things that you might want to ask: does the lawyer that you're interviewing, will he or she be actively involved in talking to the client, or is he or she a rainmaker that is going to get you signed up as a client and then hand you off to some junior lawyer down the hall? Now, there's nothing wrong with junior lawyers being involved. Very often, that's the least expensive way to solve a problem, by getting younger folks involved at different hourly rates. But you don't want to be in a position when you're the client of just getting handed off to someone else. You've really lost the opportunity to learn from the wisdom that is hopefully what you're hiring for when you interview the lawyers to begin with. So I would encourage folks to keep an open mind and invest the time to get to know a few different alternatives before they make a decision.
Yeah, and you mentioned something there, Jonathan, that it seems to me is important for folks, is that you're not just hiring an attorney for technical knowledge, but the experiences of, you're really hiring some of the experiences of that attorney, right? That has had years seeing what others have done, both right and wrong, that maybe you can learn from.
Absolutely. I like to think that, you know, I've gotten kicked in the teeth enough times by life to sort of know where the monsters are lurking. And very often that's what you're paying me for. Mm. You know, I didn't build your business. You're the subject matter expert in whatever your business is. I'm going to learn from you. But I have been down this path of trying to sell business, building them up, perfecting them, growing them, selling them. So I know in which weeds the monsters are lurking, and hopefully I can help to guide you away from them if we're working together.
So I want to give you a chance to puff your chest out a little bit and brag. Okay. That's what this show's for. And we have no shame about that. I would love it if you would share maybe a success story or two that you're particularly proud of in terms of clients that you've worked with. And you don't have to necessarily mention by name unless that's appropriate.
Sure. Well, you know, let me give you two examples if I could.
Sure.
One big client and one little client. The big client was called Designer Shoe Warehouse. Big company. They did a strategic transaction that they announced about 7 or 8 months ago with Jennifer Lopez, big celebrity. Our law firm got hired to represent Designer Shoe Warehouse in that negotiation, which lasted almost a year. I'm not allowed to talk about the terms of it, but as you can imagine, when you're dealing with people at that level, they have big law firms and big consulting firms involved. And it was a complicated joint venture that allowed Jennifer Lopez to be involved in designing shoes that have her name on them. You can go to the Designer Shoe Warehouse website today and buy shoes that have her name on them. And we were part of structuring that transaction. That was a successful effort because it was so large and complicated. It involved all different types of compensation, including both cash and equity. So that was a lot of fun. People looking to do large strategic transactions like that can find teams at Taylor English that are able to help. On the small side of things, I won't name this particular client, but there was a software company here in Atlanta, had a very unusual line of business. They were actually involved in developing software for slot machines, which is actually a thing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the largest slot machine manufacturers in the world wanted to work with this little Atlanta company, and they did a strategic transaction in which the large company made an investment and owned about 20% of the capital of the Atlanta company. And the Atlanta company, in essence, became a captive vendor to the slot machine company. They were so good at all the things that go to make a slot machine successful, and there's a whole science to this, which I couldn't begin to explain, that they became such a big piece of profit for the bigger company that the bigger company said, we just need to buy you out because we're paying you too much. You're too valuable to us for us to ever let you go. Now, the local entrepreneur that owned the other 80% was happy to do that transaction, but he wanted to make sure that he didn't have to pay ordinary income tax rates on the amount that he was going to get paid. And so with a local Atlanta accounting firm, we were able to structure that deal in such a way that the entrepreneur sold his equity over time and in a way that allowed him to recognize the gains at the long-term capital gains rate, a difference in 40% to 10% in terms of his marginal tax rate. That decision was able to save him millions over a period of years. And that was a very successful outcome for him. So those are two transactions, one for a large client, one for a small client, that both resulted in a good result. And I hope it shows that we're able to work in multidisciplinary teams, bringing in tax lawyers, intellectual property lawyers, ERISA lawyers, whatever is required, ultimately with the goal of delivering value to the client.
Great work here from Jonathan Wilson, partner with Taylor English Duma. Jonathan, this has been great. Really have enjoyed this. And I'm sure there are others who have listened to this that want me to get to the important question, which is how they can be in touch. So why don't we tell them how they can be in touch and in contact with you and your firm?
Sure. I am very easy to find. Our website, TaylorEnglish.com. That's T-A-Y-L-O-R, English like the language.com. Has bios for all of our lawyers, including me, Jonathan Wilson. My email address is there, jwilson@taylorenglish.com. And just like everyone else, I get my emails 24 hours a day. And I would love to hear from people that have heard this recording and are interested in having a conversation.
Sounds great. Jonathan Wilson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Folks, just a quick reminder that if you've got some other headaches that might involve maybe bookkeeping, maybe you've got administrative tasks you need to outsource, well, I've got a suggestion for you, and it involves picking up the phone and calling Essie Escobedo over at Office Angels. Now, she's at 770-442-9246, and she's got a whole team of angels that can fly in, get the job done, and fly out. They've been virtual for 18 years, so they understand how to work in this environment. And they're a talented group, and I know that personally. So give Essie a call, 770-442-9246, or go to officeangels.us for more information. And just one other note, you can listen to this show on the podcast app of your choice. And I said of your choice. We're on all of them. North Fulton Business Radio is the search term. We would love it if you would subscribe. We love it even more if you would rate us and give us a great review, because it helps folks find the show and find great business leaders like Jonathan who they might be able to benefit from using in their business. So that would be helpful. And you can also find us online at northfultonbusinessradio.com. Our some 270 or so episodes that we've had over the last 4 years. And you can connect with us on social media, North Fulton, BRX, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. So for my guest, Jonathan Wilson, I'm John Ray. Join us next time here on North Fulton Business Radio.